to get together.
You ready, Evan? Thumbs up. All right, so we're going to take on item number 7, which is an update on the Regional Water Board enforcement priorities from Ms. Yvonne West and Ms. Diana Henry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. I'm Diana Henry from your enforcement team, and we're going to talk now about regional enforcement priorities. And so this will be a two-part presentation. Yvonne West, who was recently promoted to be the director of the Office of Enforcement, will start with an overview of some recent changes to the enforcement and the supplemental environmental policies, the latter the SEP policy, as well as the enforcement prioritization process. And then I'm going to give you a quick enforcement program update and talk about regional enforcement priorities. And so I'm handing it now to Yvonne.
So this was the overview that Diana just went through. So I just want to say good afternoon. Thanks for having me here. I'm going to be walking through, I believe the last time Chris Kerrigan was here, it wasn't that long ago, it was in May of 2017. He was discussing the enforcement policy updates, and he kind of went through the enforcement policy with, in some detail about the significant updates that were being adopted or had been adopted. I'm going to focus today primarily on the prioritization process that is outlined in the enforcement policy, and then Diana, I'll go over the state board's enforcement priorities for 2018 that they've identified, and I'll talk a little bit about SEP policy changes and updates that were recently adopted to address some legislative changes and changes in laws and statutes and our enforcement policy, and then Diana will get involved into regional board prioritization. So, generally speaking, the enforcement policy has always had acknowledged prioritization as an important exercise to go through, and I think that is because it acknowledges that we have limited enforcement resources and a need to prioritize exactly where we're going to spend those resources. Generally speaking, prioritization is just simply to provide for more efficient and meaningful enforcement. The more recent updates to the enforcement policy change a little bit of the prioritization focus from violation-specific prioritization to more of a case-specific prioritization. So it provides for a little different step process, and I'll walk through that.
I have it.
Maybe if I can get this to work. So the prioritization process is a top-down approach, and what I mean by that is that the policy envisions that environmental enforcement staff will get together with their regional boards or their state board at least annually to discuss what their priorities should be. Once they receive that direction from their regional board members and their executive management, then the policy kind of identifies how they would apply that on a fact-specific or case-specific basis. Before we get into that process, the enforcement policy, in order to implement a prioritization, requires regional boards to undertake the prioritization exercise of ranking violations and prioritizing cases. But before we discuss how that's done, it also requires that each regional board appoint an enforcement coordinator, which in this case is Diana, to assist with the prioritization of cases and implementation of the enforcement policy. It requires that enforcement staff and prosecution team meet periodically, but in no event less than quarterly, to pre-screen and analyze potential cases for discretionary enforcement. And then it says that it outlines that these meetings should include an enforcement coordinator, one or more attorney liaisons. So at the Office of Enforcement, we have dedicated liaisons to each region. Region 1's liaisons are Dan Kippen, who is in the audience, who you met earlier, and Susie Lascata, and myself. I've been an attorney liaison for your region for a number of years. I will be moving out of that role, and we'll be backfilling once we do some additional hiring. But you'll have 3 attorney liaisons, and one of the roles of those liaisons is to participate in these enforcement prioritization meetings. The intent being that, and then your lead prosecutor in this case, that would be Josh Curtis. So he's the lead of our prosecution team and our enforcement team. And the intent being that we can have candid conversations about case strategy, weaknesses and strengths of the case, and determine which cases merit spending additional time and resources on, and which cases should be moving towards formal discretionary enforcement. One other requirement that the policy identifies, or it's kind of more of a reminder, is that appropriate protocols to maintain separation of functions should be established and adhered to in that process. And I just want to take a second to kind of elaborate on what that is. It simply means that when we get to a point in the process where we're discussing specific facts of specific cases or specific dischargers, parties, at that point, we should be limiting participation to the prosecution team. Now, that doesn't mean, again, this is a top-down process, that doesn't mean that the board or Matt as the EO or other members of the program don't have an input into what the priorities are generally of enforcement or what should be done with enforcement. There's still a role to be played in establishing priorities from folks who aren't necessarily designated on the enforcement staff or the prosecution team. So what does this process look like? It's two steps. First steps is folks involved in the prioritization meetings will sit down and determine the relative significance of each violation or series of violations involved in a site or facility. And there's some more details in the policy. I'm not going to get too myopic about it today. And then once you have a sense of what those violations, how they rank or merit, there's two classifications, A and B. Then you can move on to establishing case priorities. So establishing which cases, in light of the level of violation involved and the other factors identified in the policy, merit discretionary enforcement actions. So the one thing to kind of that's important to realize in this process, and we think it's a valuable exercise, but it's only as good as the follow-through. After you prioritize, you need to have the resources dedicated to bring the cases that you've prioritized forward and follow through. There's a statement, I tried to figure out who said it, but I couldn't really attribute it to one author. It's more of a common phrase. When everything is a priority, nothing is a priority. So it's really important that all of this is done in the context of what are your resources. Because if you identify too many priorities for your resources to handle, there's a likelihood that you'll only carry the ball on each of them so far and nothing over the finish line. To that end, outside of the policy, the Office of Enforcement has identified some tools, and we've identified these tools in working with your staff and other regional board enforcement staff that can assist in making prioritization meetings efficient and effective. So these are pretty common sense tools that I put up here. Identify staff that's necessary for productive meeting before the meeting, prepare for the meeting, develop business rules, establish expectations for priority meetings, define roles and responsibilities of the staff who participate in these meetings. And then program-specific factors is kind of a good one. This is where, if as a programmer, you sit down and decide, hey, these are the kind of violations, or these are the kind of facts or factors in this program that we think would merit maybe moving a case forward for formal enforcement. Periodic check-ins with your management on those priorities, and that's kind of what we're doing today here. This is kind of the top-down. We're checking in with you guys to see what are the kind of priorities we should be looking at. What should we be identifying? And then identifying those reasonable enforcement goals, which I just referenced. The State Board for 2018 has established their enforcement priorities, and these are the three priorities listed here. Promoting enforcement and compliance assistance in disadvantaged communities and communities with financial hardship. Focusing on a method for prioritization and prosecuting enforcement cases for discharge violations of the industrial and construction general stormwater permits have been identified as a priority for this year. Focus on using all available regulatory tools, including enforcement tools, to compel responsible parties to provide replacement water to those whose drinking water supplies is contaminated by nitrates. Now, we call that nitrate specifically, but I think there are other constituents of concern that would rise to this level of priority as well. That was just the general quick overview of the statewide view view of prioritization. And before I turn over to Diana, I'm going to just mention a few things that have happened with our SEP policy recently. And again, the policy was updated to address amendments, and amended to address new laws and regulatory updates, as well as to provide greater clarity, transparency, and implementation of supplemental environmental projects, which are often a result of our formal enforcement actions. Public Resource Code Section 71118 up there, what happened there is when that was passed in 2017, it was a requirement that all Cal EPA agencies and offices develop SEP policies. Water boards were kind of ahead of the game on that. We already had our SEP policy, but there were some requirements in there that our past SEP policy didn't address. Specifically, provides for a public process for soliciting supplemental environmental projects from disadvantaged communities. So that's something that we've now worked into our policy, more of a focus on disadvantaged communities for these projects. And it requires an annual list of acceptable or pre-approved SEPs to be posted publicly so folks could pick from those lists. Or I look through that list and identify projects that they might be willing to undertake as a result of a formal enforcement action. A few other significant updates to the SEP policy. Again, a focus on disadvantaged communities and environmental justice communities. So now the policy allows for a greater portion of the SEP to be dedicated to those types of projects that benefit those communities, and a little more flexibility with oversight costs, as well as some additional leeway on MMPs, SEPs where MMPs are involved, going to those types of communities as well. The policy now requires for some additional transparency and accountability with additional reporting requirements and oversight requirements for SEPs if your region adopts SEPs. So now is required by March 31st of each year that all the regional boards submit to the Office of Enforcement summary reports on their SEPs that have been completed in that past year, any results of third-party audits, and that they annually update their SEP list, their available SEP list. There's also, you know, just a reminder that regional boards should collect oversight costs where necessary for these types of projects. And with that, that's just unless you have any specific questions on those few items, I'm going to turn this over to Diana to talk more about the regional board's enforcement prioritization.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Diving into my script here. Last time, maybe I should. Oh, okay, we're on it. Good. And then I'll fight with my microphone. Okay, the last time I presented to you about our enforcement priorities was January 2015, 3.5 years ago. And at that time, as I reported to the board, our enforcement unit staff were directing most of our attention to building and starting to implement a regional cannabis program in parallel with the Office of Enforcement, the Division of Water Rights, Region 5, the Central Valley region, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Those efforts in our office included hiring and training staff, putting together a waste discharge regulatory order that the board then adopted in August 2015, prioritizing watersheds and participating in joint watershed enforcement team inspections with Fish and Wildlife and the Division of Water Rights. We're pretty much just working as much as we could on all four prongs of our statewide cannabis regulatory strategy. And our enforcement unit staff were also working on addressing MPDS permit violations requiring assessment of mandatory minimum penalties, or MMPs. We were initiating and supporting progressive enforcement for sites with complex and cross-program violations, continuing to regularly participate in county enforcement task force meetings and efforts, including joint agency inspections and investigations and some joint enforcement efforts, and developing an internal process to regularly meet to review enforcement cases underway and prioritize new cases for enforcement, the process that Yvonne was just describing. And I think we were fairly successful on all fronts. Our cannabis program has grown from 4 dedicated staff, plus part of Stormer and me, to 17 dedicated staff across 3 units. And though we've not seen a corresponding increase in our non-cannabis enforcement resources over the past few years, we still managed to steadily reduce our backlogged MMP cases. We're improving our internal enforcement case prioritization with a lot of assistance from our OE liaisons. And office-wide, we have several complex enforcement cases underway. Some of those where we're the lead and some where we're working with other agencies on joint enforcement. And Regarding the last, see the note there, much of our enforcement work does not result in items that come to the board, but the EO's enforcement report in each agenda includes a summary of all of our formal enforcement and notices of violation that we've issued over the previous period, which is 4 to 6 weeks since the last update. In the enforcement unit, we've had some staff shifts as the cannabis program has grown, as well as one staff retirement, Cecile Morris retired. So we've spent some time over the past year filling vacancies in the enforcement unit. We've hired an environmental scientist, Kayla Heinz, for general enforcement, and two engineering geologists, Brian Fuller and Heidi Bauer, for cannabis enforcement. I hope you'll get a chance to meet them soon with cases in front of you. And we still have two veteran staff, Nancy Robinson, who mainly works on general enforcement, and Adona White, who mainly works on cannabis enforcement. We're doing a lot of training and cross-training right now, both within our unit as well as through the office. I want to make sure that all of our enforcement unit staff are able to be proficient at their primary roles, but also be able to share the workload for our routine enforcement activities within the unit, and to provide support as needed on priority enforcement cases, whatever the program, and to implement our regional enforcement priorities as we as they change over the years. Which brings me to today's topic. The updated enforcement policy recommends that on an annual basis, enforcement staff for each regional water board seek input at a regularly noticed public meeting of the regional water board and consider identifying general enforcement priorities based on input from members of the public and the regional water board members within 30 days thereafter. Earlier this year, the Office of Enforcement began posting both its and the enforcement priorities for each region on its website, and requested that each region provide its enforcement priorities to include in the posting. At that point, we hadn't had a chance to discuss regional enforcement priorities with the board, so Matt, Josh, and I put together a preliminary list that we believe reflects priorities and preferences expressed by the board in past meetings. And they're here on the slide. Coordinating enforcement and compliance assistance in disadvantaged communities and communities with financial hardship, prioritizing and pursuing enforcement cases for waste discharge violations associated with site development and use for cannabis cultivation, and prioritizing and pursuing enforcement cases for waste discharge violations associated with agricultural activities other than cannabis cultivation. And those are all areas we are doing some or more work on right now. With respect to coordinated enforcement and compliance assistance efforts in disadvantaged communities, most of the communities in our region are disadvantaged or have financial hardship, and those with individual NPDES permits and violations subject to MMPs nearly all qualify to apply all of their penalties, their MMP penalties, towards compliance project. And it's always been a priority for us in negotiating settlement agreements to work with our communities to identify and sometimes secure the additional funds needed, grant funds or low interest loan funds needed, to carry out projects to improve their facilities, correcting problems that are leading to permit violations and the adverse impacts of water quality and beneficial uses. Most of our NPDES facilities have made significant improvements to their systems in recent years. We've showcased a few in the past, and hopefully we'll have more to report on that in upcoming board meetings. Tule Lake was our most recent case. College of the Redwoods will be the next one, resolved after years of work by our staff and staff from the Office of Enforcement. And we're working with Lolita now, starting to see a long-term solution take shape. Meanwhile, on non-MPDES facilities, where we have some discretion as to the type or level of enforcement we take on violations, I believe our non-enforcement and program staff are also dedicating some of their time and effort to working with disadvantaged communities to secure funding to correct problems, hopefully helping them to find a path to correct their violations without our needing to progress to enforcement and consider assessing penalties. This is my long one here. We've said in a few cannabis presentations to the board over the years that an enforcement-only approach would not be successful in addressing all the adverse impacts to water quality and beneficial uses associated with site development and use for cannabis cultivation. With nearly 10 times the cannabis staff we had 5 years ago in 2013, when this region's cannabis staff were just Stormer and me, as well as now having both a regional and statewide regulatory program and thousands of growers enrolled in or expressing interest in complying with our programs and protecting water quality, we still regularly encounter sites with extensive grading, in-stream work, fill-in streams and wetlands, bad roads, lots of roads, and improperly contained waste and chemicals. Compliance assistance and education and outreach helps to reduce the number of sites impacting and threatening to impact water quality, but still leaves many times more sites needing enforcement than we can address through individual enforcement efforts. We can't inspect every site, and we can't take enforcement on every site we inspect at the level we might deem appropriate. We're continuing to work closely with our Fish and Wildlife and Water Rights partners to identify and focus our efforts on priority watersheds within the region, which is a bit of a challenge because there are so many to choose from. But at present, we have about six, plus or minus, that we're focusing this year's efforts on. We're sending one or more staff out almost weekly right now with various teams of law enforcement and state and local agency staff, mainly in those priority watersheds, and every outing brings back reports of significant water quality issues. There are also sites that look good, where people are making an effort to protect water quality, but we're still seeing a lot of messes. Among those sites that we inspect, and the many where we prefer to follow up with formal enforcement, we're trying to better prioritize and narrow them down to a smaller group that we'll pursue formal enforcement on. Formal enforcement, whether cleanup and abatement order or administrative civil liability, takes time to prepare and manage. There's only so many we can take on with our available staff resources, so we're trying to limit the number of cases we take on to fit those resources. Still working on it. With many of the rest, we may opt for an informal enforcement response for starters and hope that either that or enforcement by Fish and Wildlife will prompt a positive response. Internally, regardless of the type of enforcement tool we may choose to use for a given case, we're still finding that the amount of time it takes to develop and send out inspection reports is hindering our effectiveness. We're standardizing and streamlining our inspection report formats and trying to build template informal enforcement transmittal letters to shorten review times so we can get the reports out sooner. That's still a work in progress. Most of the time, we end up relying on the NOVs, notices of violation, that Fish and Wildlife send out, because they've gotten pretty good at just about turning on a dime. They can get their NOVs out in a week or two of visiting sites with violations. And many of their NOVs do prompt a compliance-sounding response from the property owner. When possible, we try to coordinate with Fish and Wildlife to review and provide input on landowner proposals to address the Fish and Wildlife NOVs and make sure our issues are addressed as well. And finally, as we've visited priority watersheds over the past few years, we've noted frequently that the shared use access roads within those watersheds are likely causing more adverse impacts to water quality than are many of the individual sites we're inspecting. We had been hesitant to tackle this through enforcement, given the anticipated time and effort and complexity associated with working with numerous responsible parties, all those landowners that have some responsibility for the road. But we decided the effort is warranted, and in June 2018, we issued our first cleanup and abatement order for a shared use road system, this in the Indian Creek watershed, tributary to the Trinity. And you probably read about that in the EO's enforcement report this month. And so far, things are working out. We're getting a positive response. We're getting communication. We've had communication with all the responsible parties and their consultants, and they're working on plans to address the water quality issues. And at the same time, a lot of those property owners and their consultants are talking about working on addressing the water quality issues on their properties apart from the shared use road. So this has been kind of a good way to just get everybody together and work on a whole lot of problems at once through this particular effort. So I expect we're going to be doing more of these, and we will give you updates as this particular case progresses as well. While not presenting quite the scale and magnitude of water quality impact seen from cannabis cultivation, non-cannabis agricultural activities of various types also impact water quality and beneficial uses throughout our region, and we've heard the board express interest and are taking more enforcement in this area. Unfortunately, at present, it's kind of a challenge. We have very limited staff resources for implementing existing agriculture waste discharge regulatory programs and for investigating and taking enforcement on water quality issues associated with agricultural activities. Consequently, we must consider and prioritize every agriculture-related enforcement effort that we may want to get involved in, and we involve ourselves only in a limited number of high-priority cases. We've had to rely heavily on the investigation and enforcement efforts by other agencies, and we try to provide support where we can on those. We're working internally to come up with a way to dedicate more staff resources to high priority non-cannabis ag cases now. And hopefully we can update you on the progress on that as well at future board meetings for EO's reports. So that's a review of the categories presently posted as regional enforcement priorities and some of our efforts underway. We believe they're worthy priorities and we're dedicating time and effort towards them. However, they don't take into account feedback from all the programs within our office nor from the board and the public. So as noted in the USR for this item, after submitting our preliminary regional enforcement priorities to OE for posting, we spent some time internally talking to managers and program managers to see whether they had comments or recommended changes to the priorities. And based on those discussions, we came up with a few proposed changes. First, we recommend removing the priority of coordinating enforcement and compliance assistance for disadvantaged communities. Not because we don't consider it important, and as I've stated earlier, it's a standard consideration for us every time we work with a regulated community to settle an enforcement action and address violations, and under the new SEP policy, we'll be looking to settle more of our enforcement cases with projects that benefit small and disadvantaged communities. However, since it's a routine consideration that we'll continue to work on, it comes up regularly whether or not it's a priority because we have to keep up with the MMP backlog. And because it involves as much or more compliance assistance as enforcement, we deem it appropriate to not include it as a regional enforcement priority. Next, we recommend adding three priorities, and those are pursuing non-filers under all applicable regulatory programs, pursuing timely enforcement on missed deadlines in existing enforcement orders, and scaling up our regulatory oversight and enforcement for violations of NPDES stormwater permits. So, pursuing non-filers under our regulatory programs. Apart from the cannabis program, we haven't made a concerted enrollment enforcement effort in our other regulatory programs in recent years. We've built a fairly good model for enrollment enforcement under our cannabis program, typically sending letters to hundreds of property owners at a time. For our other programs, this effort would probably be more on the scale of tens of dischargers or sites than hundreds, so hopefully easier to track and manage. I expect that the way this would work is program staff in the various regulatory programs, such as timber, 401, stormwater, future ag permits, whatever permits, would identify sites needing regulatory coverage and then initiate enrollment enforcement. If initial enrollment directive and then a subsequent NOV threatening penalties within a short time frame don't yield positive results, that would probably be the time for program staff to refer individual facilities to the enforcement unit to seek penalties. Timely enforcement on missed deadlines. In general, given the amount of time and effort it takes us to issue enforcement orders, and given that we're issuing those to the cases we've deemed to be the highest priority for this level of enforcement, it's appropriate that we then closely track compliance, communicate with the discharger regularly to encourage compliance, and then take prompt progressive enforcement if deadlines are missed. As regional enforcement coordinator, I'm trying to get a better idea of the enforcement activity occurring throughout our office, and to encourage updates at our enforcement prioritization meetings on cases that might lead to progressive enforcement. We find that many of the enforcement actions we report on in the EO's enforcement report are resulting in compliance responses, satisfactory responses to address violations, but I think we could improve on the timeliness of follow-up where we're not seeing compliance, and enforcement staff aren't necessarily always tracking the progress of informal or lower-level enforcement efforts being conducted by our specific programs. Scaling up our regulatory oversight and enforcement for violation of NPDES stormwater permits, which this will be kind of a slow scaling up because we're in the process now of hiring and training up a whole new team of staff. Mona Doherty has moved over to cannabis, so we'll be hiring a new senior to fill her previous position leading our NPDES program. We've also recently hired a new engineer, Summer El-Satarwa, to be lead on the Industrial General Stormwater Program. We've had an environmental scientist, Brendan Thompson, transfer from our 401 unit to become the lead of the Municipal Stormwater Program. And we're in the process of filling an engineering geologist position to be in charge of the Construction Stormwater Program. So there's some training underway, and it's timely. I'm able to have some of our new enforcement staff also train alongside the new stormwater staff. We'll learn the program and train up with the staff they're gonna be working with later on for stormwater enforcement. Our past enforcement efforts in this program have mainly focused on making sure that enrolled facilities are submitting their annual monitoring reports, and then we've been contacting enrollees who are reporting effluent limit violations in their monitoring reports, hoping to encourage voluntary efforts to make changes to their facilities or operations to improve the quality of their stormwater discharges. So the scaling up that we're proposing will be progressing to enforcement orders that we'd be issuing on facilities that continue to report permit limit violations, then requiring that their owners and operators start making the improvements to their facilities and BMPs as necessary to improve, to reduce the amount of pollutants in their, the amount of potential for rainwater to get in contact with pollutants, and treatment to reduce the amount of pollutants that are leaving the facility and getting into receiving waters. It's clear that whatever our regional enforcement priorities, there will be more cases or sites within each category than we can address individually. So they're all priorities and none of them are, and it's hard to get anything done. So our internal group proposed a few additional criteria we might apply to identify the top priority cases for formal enforcement. Those are the criteria listed here. Violation has resulted in threats or impacts to critical habitat. Violation has affected a water of the state that resource protection agencies, including the water boards, have spent money restoring. A violation is contributing to a watershed impairment, and or the violation has resulted in impacts to a public drinking water supply. And this isn't something we're proposing to post with enforcement priorities, but just to tell you, just to let the board and the public know, these are additional criteria we'll use internally to screen and prioritize cases for formal enforcement. Our internal group also recognized that it's difficult to predict what types of events or violations we may encounter at any time. We thought it best to acknowledge that at times there are cases outside our priorities that are just so significant we must take formal enforcement. Cases where there have been particularly significant impacts to water resource or beneficial uses, or cases where the conduct of the responsible party in causing or creating the violation was particularly egregious. And I'll also note that the enforcement policy includes a category of violations Yvonne briefly mentioned, Class A priority violations. Those are violations that potentially pose an immediate and substantial threat to beneficial uses and or have the potential to individually or cumulatively cause significant detrimental impacts to human health or the environment. The enforcement policy provides a number of examples of what might constitute a Class A violation, and these are probably our high threats and significant impacts, and egregious discharge or conduct are probably among those. In general, we would expect or attempt to take some level of formal enforcement action on violations in general that fit this definition. So those are the regional enforcement priorities and ideas we proposed based on our internal discussions. And now here we are at a regularly noticed public meeting, and we are ready to seek input from the public and from you, our board members.
Thank both of you. You know, I got to say, with respect to enforcement, it's something that we don't see a lot of the time, right? That I'm always looking back in the back of this packet that we get to see what you guys are up to. I was talking with Josh about it last night over dinner just a minute, and just, you know, about enforcement is something that oftentimes doesn't make it to us. So I'm curious from you, Diane, since last time we spoke, what is your burden with enforcement? You've got, it sounds like, a handful of staff. You've got more priority than you can handle, and there's an administrative burden to enforcement, simply because you're going to walk this out potentially to separation of powers and potentially an enforcement case. So you have to handle probably everyone as if it could go that way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with prioritization even, you know, how many cases are you handling it, say, in a given year or a given time? And has cannabis just overwhelmed you guys because now you're looking underneath the carpet to see what's under there?
Cannabis has kind of overwhelmed us, and you know, we're still trying to, we're seeing a lot of sites, we're bringing a lot of things back that we need to document. You know, every step of the process takes some time, and with so many cases to, we see so many bad things, you know, we'd say automatically, well, that needs a cleanup and abatement order. It's like, and that, and that, and that, and that, and And so just kind of catching up with that and figuring out, well, okay, quicker ways to get some of these parts of the process done. Develop that, figure that out, develop that template, standardize something, come up with something that maybe can forego legal review, something that can go out at a lower level or go out directly from staff. So it's just, it's all kind of building the process at the same time as we're trying to keep up with it. It is a new, you know, any of our other programs, there's never enough staff to keep up with things, but cannabis is just in kind of an avalanche. So there's a lot of that, but with our dedicated enforcement staff, we have, like a couple of years ago, if you looked at what was defined as a backlogged MMP site, we had about 18 of them, facilities where we had not addressed MMPs within 18 months of them being reported. And now I think it's down to, I can count them on one hand, I think we have about four right now that look like they have more than about three violations that are in the warrant penalties. So that's been a slow and steady progress in a good direction. We are trying to become more capable in taking on cases where there's a lot of grading and there's stream filling, not necessarily for cannabis, but just kind of a cross-program type enforcement case where all the different units are kind of like, but that looks more like that. We can only do so many of those, but you know, we learn from each one, and hopefully we'll get more efficient. So what's the number? It's, you know, look in the enforcement, EO's enforcement report and count them, and we've probably got another 50 to 100 cases that we're tracking in some fashion right now that are underway from informal to formal.
Well, enforcement to me also strikes me from 13267 directive letters all the way up, right? Mm-hmm. That's where we establish regulatory authority, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. that gives us authority, and if you don't start to go forward from there, you know, you're subject then to progressive enforcement or additional steps, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, that enforcement, certainly I know that there's an underlying philosophy of using enforcement as a tool to broadcast a message, right? Certainly in cannabis, I think that's the case, right? I believe it can be effectively used in the cleanup world, frankly, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot of, if I look at our backlog, I work in the cleanup world as a consultant, and you know, there's a fair number of sites out there that are just open and active sites. And I see that staff has been perfectly willing to write a letter of, hey, we asked you for that work plan in 2007. I wrote another letter in 2012. And in 2018, I'm going to write you another letter. And yet we've got some leaking tank site that I get it. At times, there's very difficult to move some of those sites forward. I've had specific discussions at time with staff about, as a board member, to please use an infill cleanup and abatement order. I think there are times where cleanup and abatement order is absolutely necessary, whether it be that you have a consultant that just is bumbling along and getting paid by the fund to do it, or that it's ineffective of what they're doing and means and methods isn't something that this staff is actually, you know, going to tell a consultant that, hey, I think you should do this or that, or I'm going to mandate that you do that. I think that enforcement in specifically agriculture endeavors, non cannabis, can be very effective. To send a message. We've talked about that in some of our priority watersheds on the north end of our region, mm-hmm. Specifically with related to animal agriculture and some of the row crop agriculture, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as using it, it seems to me that we have a limited and small pool of enforcement ability,
mm-hmm.
but certainly I think making a priority out of it and trying to send a message and using some of our tools maybe a good use of our time.
Mm-hmm.
When it was just you and Stormer out there swinging at it, you know, I get it. I get you're trying to, you know, like you said, you know, if everything's a priority, nothing gets done. At the same time, I do think, and it is worth it to look at time strategically at enforcement. And I know you do, you know, but look at it from the standpoint of sometimes a well-placed enforcement case could send a very big message out there. At the same time, you know, I got to admit, you know, Vaughn, we were talking last night over dinner, and I think you said we can find 54 enforcement officers or something like that.
But for all their program areas, yeah.
Yeah.
For three offices.
Yeah,
you know,
which is a huge region with all kinds of things going on. But the other thing is that from a philosophy of enforcement, you know, I would imagine that you know, deputizing staff in essence. Everybody has the ability to raise the enforcement realm from here, right? Whether it be an inspector or somebody going out on the site reviewing a case or whatever it is, or becoming aware of something. I don't know how necessarily that filters its way up to, you know, staff. I know that Josh, you're pretty much the guy that issues some of the meaner end of the stick. So you're such a nice guy too, but you know what?
Don't know me.
Let me rephrase that. You look like that. Maybe you're not so nice.
I think it helps. I mean, let me just say, I think it really helps when the board does say, well, hey, we'd like to see, you know, for instance, you just said animal agriculture or CAFOs. We'd like to see, because in a region this size, you're competing with all of your other regulatory functions too. And so, I mean, you have enforcement staff, but as we discussed, you know, you have 17 cannabis staff. They're not all enforcement. Out of those 17, I think Matt said 5 last night, or 4, or 4 out of 17 identified as enforcement. And then, you know, limited 1 and maybe a few extra to other program areas. I think that's when it becomes important to acknowledge that your enforcement staff have other obligations. And if there is an area where this board feels enforcement needs to be more aggressive or more prevalent or more routine, then there needs to be acknowledgement of that, because you're going to have to pull from some of your other regulatory duties.
Yeah, it becomes a zero net gain, right?
Yeah.
Okay, at the same time, when we ask you, Matt, have we requested out of the State Board or Office of Personnel or whatever it is that we make personnel requests for, have we asked for more enforcement staff explicitly?
There have been statewide requests for additional enforcement staff, yeah. And those requests have not been, other than the cannabis program, those requests have not been filled.
But, you know, in the cannabis program, you got a significant influx of resources with an identification that enforcement is a priority in that program. So that'll be an important program to show some.
Well, frankly, too, cannabis is a pretty rich field to plow when it comes to enforcement.
Right.
That's a very, very big world that I'm sure that, because the Wild West has been going on for 30 to 40 years out there, we're going to see, you guys got to be seeing some pretty interesting stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I would imagine. Yeah. Mr. Corbett, did you want to ask a question?
Oh, I wanted to know, what is the total number of enforcement staff we have on board now?
Our unit is...
For the agency-wide on all matters.
Our enforcement unit is me and a staff of 5, and we're going to hire also a scientific aide, but we haven't advertised for it. So we've had 3 of my 5 staff are dedicated cannabis, 2 are general enforcement. Storm are also our enforcement our enforcement specialist is funded with cannabis. So what, there's 7 of us.
And then what percent of our enforcement is handled by the state versus the regional board staff?
Of our enforcement, Office of Enforcement staff, technical and legal assist us on a number of our cases. They are lead on a few, but I'd say maybe 15% to 20%.
Yeah, we were very active in the beginning of the cannabis program, both with our investigative staff and our legal staff, in developing some of the enforcement actions that have come forward. And we've scaled back a little bit now because Region 1 does have a significant amount that is the most staffed cannabis staff out of the whole state, and now that we have the whole state, we've been offering a lot of our time, not our legal support. Our legal support has stayed steady, but our staff, our technical staff support, our investigators have been spending more time in other regions that are just developing their investigation units and just starting to do inspections, so we've been more active in those regions and backed away from Region 1 as far as that technical support, but our legal support remains the same, and we have been very active in Region 1 in helping assist with the development of business rules and prioritization goals and outcomes, accountability for the program. We've been working very closely with Josh to try to streamline some of these. We spent a lot of time trying to develop templates for the region so that staff can bring those cases forward.
Still have to get through review.
Yeah, on a more timely basis. We'd love to see we'd love to see those business rules be implemented and some goals about timeline of inspection reports and when they come out. So yeah, we've been pretty active.
Well, I was trying to get the percent, and the thrust of it was the statewide program was trying to beef up enforcement, is trying to ensure more consistent fine rates. And I know some regional boards were totally afraid the state program would take them over. And we actually, or myself, certainly supported it right from day one. It made a lot of sense to me, but I'm still trying to get, do we have a sizable regional board enforcement currently that's separate from the state enforcement? Because we have that option. And are we doing it all through the state, or?
None of the enforcement comes before the state. Is when we function with the regional board, we operate collaboratively. All of the decisions about which cases, which strategy come to you is made by your regional board staff and your regional board. We, as your attorneys, offer options, and then we come forward with the cases that are chosen from our staff. We do not set the penalties. That is all through the enforcement staff and your prosecution team. We don't take anything before the state board. We coordinate with the state board programs when, for instance, there's, like, you just recently heard Marble Mountain. There was water quality and water rights concerns in Marble Mountain. So we coordinated that case with the division because we are the attorneys for both the division and the regional board. But nothing that we do in assisting your regional board staff becomes quote-unquote state board enforcement, where we make any of the strategic calls or otherwise determine penalty amounts or violations that are alleged. Those are all determined through the regional board enforcement staff.
Thank you. Very good answer. Now my question is both statewide, regionally, do you think our fining system is more consistent than it was? Because that was one of the whole reasons for your...
For the policy?
For the creation of your division. So.
Yeah, I think there is a lot more consistency. There's a lot more dialogue across the regional board lines about what different regions are doing, what type of enforcement actions. There's a sharing of resources and tools. We'll often develop tools, for instance, the expedited payment letter tool that was developed through, I believe it started in Region 4. It's an MMP tool. I don't know if Region 1 is even using it yet, but I think they are.
We do it quite often.
Yeah, and so, you know, we develop processes in other areas or through other programs, and then we'll bring them to the rest of the regional boards. We also do a condensed ACL process, which if your stormwater ramps up this next year, will be something we'll be bringing to Diana to consider using, because it's something we found to be very effective in Region 2 when dealing with stormwater issues. So just as a matter, and because our attorneys from the Office of Enforcement are involved in regional board enforcement across the state, we can do things and talk to Diana and the rest of the enforcement staff about, what is the potential harm of the discharge of sanitary sewer overflows? Oh, well, in Region 2 and 4 and 5, they usually rate them a 3 or a 2. And that plays into the methodology, and that's where you get the consistency. So, you know, the characteristic of a discharge in Region 1 isn't any different than the characteristic of a discharge in Region 9, and everybody's...
Yeah, maybe far higher.
But then the impact is a different factor, mm-hmm. and that would play into that factor. But that methodology and the policy and our involvement in multiple regions and programs has definitely improved the consistency that you see across the state.
Good. Well, congratulations. That was an important goal. I just wanted to comment... I think we're playing pretty well statewide. The one area that I get a lot of criticism is Humboldt Bay. They think we're way collaborative. We never enforce. Now, I've tried to go and ask questions, and most of the questions, in my opinion, didn't reflect a lack of enforcement. One of them is on dioxins, Humboldt Bay, and we haven't followed through on the TMDL. However, most people feel that's a very tiny problem, and that's more in the TMDL planning. There's a lot of criticism, of course, that we have some of the highest coliform beaches in California. But our staff are trying to study that, and we're trying to determine, believe it or not, whether that's wild birds are polluting our beaches. I got to get those wild birds under control. No, so if I listened, but I did want to give, that's the only place I'm picking up an image just a little bit. And I'll give you the names of the two people involved, and maybe you can straighten them up a little bit.
So since policy statements can be used to back up funding requests, I think we should have a policy statement on enforcement added to the list. Just our statement about how we're doing.
I think that's very smart. I think to encourage effective use of enforcement tools. I think that's very smart.
Yes, we have something.
Sounds good. The other thing, a couple questions that come to mind, MMPs, is that really out of CWICS, and that's really an accounting out of CWICS is where that comes from? Because that's really effluent discharge exceedance, and it also comes from sanitary sewer overflows, I believe. Is that correct, actually?
The MPDS, the individual MPDS permit, but, yep. Permits have effluent limits,
yep.
And dischargers report their, in their monitoring reports, how they measured up, what their monitoring results were. And if they exceed their effluent limits, then those are effluent limit violations, and they're subject to mandatory minimum penalties. Late reporting can also be subject to MMPs. Sanitary sewer overflows are separate. Those are subject to discretionary penalties. And in the past, we have generally pursued penalties for SSOs that were 50,000 gallons or greater. We have a few of those that have been reported more recently, so we're kind of reviewing those right now. When we're reviewing the violations that may be subject to MMPs, we will look at dischargers monitoring reports in addition to looking at just pulling what's in CWICS, just to make sure that everything's been reported accurately. And we're seeing better data quality now than we were in the first years of electronic reporting. ESMRs.
Can I ask you too, Diana, with respect to stormwater? You know, so we have three stormwater programs, the municipal investment construction, right?
Mm-hmm.
Use of enforcement specifically, look at the industrial first. But the industrial is a system that was always and still is built on the backbone of, you assess your facility with a pollutant characterization, you build BMPs and practices that will control and minimize or negate those impacts,
mm-hmm.
and then you test, verify, and amend. And in fact, the update to the Industrial General Permit 2012 included a tiered structured system, right? That some people on tier three, everybody started tier zero. I talked to a guy yesterday, they're tier two, so they're kind of up the list a bit. And that at the same time, the industrial permit has numeric action limits. They have instantaneous, and then they have annual averages. There's also been issues with some of the background with industrial has exceedances, aluminum and iron, which are two of the most common elements on the face of the earth, because basically we're all made out of that, or all our soil matrix and mineral base is pretty much based on that background. It's been a very hard thing for some of these sites to control. And some of those action limits came out of EPA guidelines, I believe. They're not something that were made up by the state of California, but they've been a bit problematic. So my question to you is, how do you envision in the industrial stormwater, which, by the way, they used the SIC system, the Standard Industrial Classification System, to identify sites that are stormwater sites.
Mm-hmm.
And that leaves a fair amount of the universe out of industrial stormwater requirements. How and what is the intent on industrial stormwater enforcement if it becomes a priority?
I would submit that that's going to be a discussion with the our MPDS program, the stormwater program.
Yeah.
Any enforcement effort that we take is discretionary enforcement. We're not bound to having to assess penalties on specific
right.
things. So we'll be reviewing the requirements of the permits and the types of monitoring reports we're getting, and I would imagine that the stormwater staff would and their management would be recommending what are the priorities to take enforcement on. So I'm not prepared to answer your question.
That's okay. It's a big world.
Yes, absolutely.
It is a big world. It's interesting that the use and the updating of, especially the construction permit, which really got a lot of construction folks engaged.
Mm-hmm.
There's people out there that are the, you know, industrial or construction stormwater kind of professional community out there that work on that front. Certainly, it's a big world, and I think it's interesting that SMARTS is the depository of information out there, because their Clean Water Act permits under MPDS, they're subject to citizen lawsuits, and mm-hmm. there's frankly some people out there that run around in that world, and they're litigious as a result.
So let me just address a few of those concerns, Chair Norton. This is where our experience comes in, is helpful to an extent. I mean, Region 4 has been very, very active in industrial stormwater enforcement, and it is not the easiest permit to enforce. It is an iterative permit, but it also provides a lot of slack for complying with that iterative process. But there's still room to focus on the enforcement, meaning to spend the time to identify those parties which are participating actively in that process, who are falling behind. A lot of the enforcement has been for non-filers. And there has been some active litigation, and I don't know if you're aware, but our office has joined with USDOJ and has filed briefs against some of the citizen suit actions, which we found to not be requiring substantive injunctive relief as a result of settling their claims. And some of them that are alleging violations that we don't feel are actual violations of the industrial stormwater permit.
Well, the other side of that too is that, you know, when I talked about deputizing or using regular line staff or staff that are out there with doing the front, they're not in essence then dedicated enforcement staff. The one thing I'd recommend is reaching out to some of our CUPA agencies, you know, mm-hmm. our certified unified public agencies. We have local CUPA agencies in most municipalities. They're front-end inspectors. They're out there inspecting these facilities. At times, they've had some stormwater authority. Certainly, if we look at the municipal stormwater front, the MS4 program, every MS4 municipality is subject then to controlling within their area stormwater discharge. And I actually talked to a regional municipality recently that they did not then require a facility to have an industrial stormwater permit program. And I told them, I said, you guys are crazy, because now you have taken responsibility that if you don't make them control that, they're going to discharge you, and now that's all yours. So I didn't understand myself why they would not have been active out there on the CUPA front. But certainly the CUPA and the CUPA forum may be a very good place to actually bring the Office of Enforcement. CUPA forums every year. I spoke at the CUPA forum as a professional.
We participate at most years.
It would be a great place to bring that to the fore and deputize the entire CUPA world out there to have their game on when it comes to municipal and industrial stormwater. They are out there, and it would be a really rich area to look at, I think. It's in the best interest of these municipalities that are covered under MS4,
mm-hmm.
in my mind. All right, I really appreciate the update, the opportunity. Any other questions from the board? All right, I got a couple speaker cards. How about we do that, and we'll finish.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, let's take the Regina Chikadola, followed by Bob Lee.
You sit here?
If you can sit wherever you want.
I usually do some podium or something.
Sure.
Hi, my name is Regina Chikazola. I'm here today with the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. And I would like to first say that I like the additional prioritization for ESA critical habitat. I think that is a good change. I feel like ag and non-point is not regulated enough within our region, which is the main pollution source within our region, non-point pollution, once you get north of this area at least. I feel like there should be a focus of violation in high quality waters and flow impaired waters, especially when there's no assimilative capacity for the pollution. The Scott River would be an example of something like this, where there is high nutrient loading but not much water in the summertime to have assimilated capacity. I also feel like the Scott, Shasta, Southport, Trinity, Smith, Dale, and Klamath as main watersheds that are important to ESA listed species should be areas where we have some more examples of enforcement. I feel like taking some key cases where there are blatant people violating water quality standards or not meeting their permits would bring the stick to the carrot and stick example. And I do like that you guys brought that up in the Scott and Shasta waivers, that we need more enforcement within those areas. There are cases where water quality investigations have shown that there are just a few people that are the bad guys or that are not trying to make changes. So making an example of those people, I think, especially in critical areas, could be really helpful. Within this region, I feel like the disadvantaged communities are also often not the polluters, but the people that are dealing with the impacts of the pollution. This would be the Klamath would be a good example of that, where tribal people are dealing with the extreme pollution that's coming from upriver and from people that are not dealing with enforcement actions. So while we're thinking about disadvantaged communities, I would think of people like the Yurok tribe, the Talua, Krug tribe, and work with those folks to bring enforcement actions to this board. Because obviously those people are on the ground and can help you figure out where the pollution is coming from. I feel like this board should work as closely as possible with the state board and Fish and Wildlife to go after flow impairments and other enforcement actions where they might have more power than the board does, but because this board is on the ground also, might have examples to bring to Fish and Wildlife and the state board. Like for in the Scott and Shasta, for instance, in your investigations, you might find that the people are violating flow criteria and that could go to the state board or Fish and Wildlife. So yeah, work with the other agencies when possible. And I'd like to suggest that eventually, sorry to go over my time, but that this board looks into putting someone into an office north of this area so that these high quality waters and critical habitats can be focused on for enforcement, because it's hard to do it from here. Thank you.
Regina, thank you. Thank you for your comments today, and thank you for your comments as we were up at the Shasta meeting. Yeah, I appreciate it. Bob Lee, you're my last speaker card.
Chair Norin, board members, and Diana and Yvonne. Boy, Yvonne jumped into a big pair of shoes there with Chris Kerrigan's feet, but she seems to be filling that pair of shoes nicely. So it was great to hear the conversation about enforcement. This is always something Riverkeeper is really interested in. We frankly don't feel like we see enough of it. And with the expansion of the enforcement unit, we're looking forward to seeing more of it. Certainly we're excited about that. I do want to point out that last bullet on that slide. Oh, beautiful timing. I guess it's time for me to go. Yeah, wasn't that? That's my cue to get out of here. Consider identifying general enforcement priorities based on input from members of the public. We would love to be engaged in that. And that I know that's something you're considering, but please, that is something we would love to be talking about. Thank you, Chair Norin, for the comment on the Koopas. When I was working here at this board and I was working in the stormwater department under Mona and John, that was one thing that I was working with, is trying to get the Koopa inspectors to go out and talk about stormwater with all the people that they were inspecting. And a lot of them just didn't have any, had no, association with the water board or had ever been even asked to do so. So that's a great idea for municipal and industrial stormwater inspecting. And then I'm really pleased to hear that Diana will be working with the new staff and figuring out ways to bring enforcement against industrial and construction, particularly construction. One thing I see out there in the watershed right now is a lot of people are rebuilding and they're taking bulldozers right down along creeks and literally bulldozing lines right adjacent to creeks just to put a fence in. And there's tons of sediment. I mean, you know, 20 cubic yards of loose sediment getting ready to slough into the creeks. And this will be happening in, you know, the rain, during the rain season. And they don't know that, that there's, you know, anything wrong with that. So we will be calling Diana and letting her know about some of these areas out there. And the other thing that I really liked hearing about was the fact that there's boots on the ground out there right now. It might be cannabis related, but there are actually people out there inspecting sites and actually having a presence in the watersheds and actually looking at the problems so they can bring them back and do something about some of these enforcement issues. So that's really what we've been hoping for the last, you know, a long time. It's people on the ground. So I think that was it. Yeah, and thank you for seeking out other ag-related violators. That's a big deal for us too. And thanks for the presentation, and thank you all.
Hey, Bob, I want to throw one thing. Russian River, you guys are on the water a lot out there on the Russian River.
Yes.
You're on the community for sure. You're an important component. One thing I'd point out to you, the September board meeting has an update on some of the fire response of the fire complex in Napa County. I'd invite you back. You're kind of a bar fight at our meeting in a really great way. And so I'd be sure and come back and reiterate those comments about your, what if you are truly seeing that stuff, for one thing, make it known now. You have, if you've got specific cases, make it known now. But certainly come and be part of that conversation about what you guys are seeing out there and your concern.
Look forward to it.
Thank you so much. All right, I don't really have any other closing comments here. If others do, please say so. Diana, I very much appreciate your work. Yvonne and Dan, thank you for coming our way. It's been very nice, as always, to interact with the enforcement both up and down the line here. It's an important component of what we do. It's a part of the bargain and how regulatory works. In essence, I think there's we could do this the easy way or we could do it the hard way. I'm not saying that compliance is easy, but at the same time, once you get into that enforcement process, you can get in the wash and dry cycle, and it's not easy to get out of it. It's not easy for the burden of staff. I appreciate the work that's been done. The only request that I have is that I always look at the last section back here as part of my review of this package, and I get to see kind of what's going on. Oftentimes it doesn't mention watershed, so I don't know where these sites are. Sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. It might be good to add a little bit more specifics in here. Mm-hmm. I don't think more detail would hurt. I'm not trying to add to your burden, by the way. Just the curiosity on my side makes me wonder, you know, it's like, wow, that's interesting. Where is this site or what's going on here? It kind of keeps us a little bit apprised about what you're doing and where it's going.
Okay.
So, Mr. John.
Oh, I just wanted to say, this goes back maybe 9 months ago. In talking to enforcement on a case, everyone had different perspectives on how to handle. One thing that was clarified is that we're a board that doesn't mind subpoenas. Because apparently some regional boards don't like it. I think it's just part of your job and want to make sure you feel supported with that, and that's not an issue that pays to come back for board consultation on. Yes, of course you do it. You're expected to show the economic stuff. You got to subpoena the records for that. So I just want to make sure you knew we had that support, which to me is self-evident, but apparently it isn't in some regions, so it is here.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
Great.
Thank you, Diana. Stay in touch with us. Let us know how it goes. If you need something from us, you always know where we're at.
And think about topics you'd like for future, focused enforcement presentations or, you know, looking at some of our cases. And I guess same as what on the earlier item, send your request to Matt.
Well, maybe in keeping with that, let's just put it out here. I think that it would be good when we have presentation from staff on say, a program, whether it's, I assume, we'll have cannabis update. Mm-hmm. You guys always include a component of enforcement. I would like to see that actually, say, like any other programs, if we get an update on the dairy program, we get updated on forestry, to have a component that we know that's out there. What is the actions that you've seen in enforcement? Sure. Where's the priority about enforcement from this perspective of staff out here implementing these programs? I think that would be really good to know from our standpoint, because if we go to update a program one of these rigs, I think it'd be good to know maybe how we can make them better or more effective.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet.